You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
Let him go. He's saying, get out of the way. I want to play some rugby.
The Playbook, 95BFM sports podcast. Nothing but sports, sports, and more sports.
Get it, pitch him. Right, yes, he's running, he's clear. He's saying, look at me.
Kia ora, how's it going? This is The Playbook, 95BFM's dedicated sports podcast. My name is Joe, and I'm accompanied by my co-host, Amelia.
Kia ora.
How's it going?
Bloody good. I'm excited to talk about some sports with my besties.
In case you forgot, 95BFM's The Playbook offers an alternative view of the vast sporting universe. Now, you're probably wondering what that all means. The Playbook covers everything that your usual sports headlines don't. We'll be here every week to give you the latest on the things that you may or may not know anything about that's sports related. Sometimes. Let's kick it off. We've got a big show planned, Amelia.
Yes, we do. And if you're keen to catch up on The Playbook, you can find anything Playbook related on 95bfm.com/bcast. That's where all The Playbook podcasts will live.
Football, cricket, Quidditch. The Playbook's got it.
Amelia, we've had you on the show before to talk about motorsport. You're a massive F1 fan.
Yes, all things motorsport. Unless you ask me how to drive a car, that is my one lacking area. But if you want to know anything about F1, motorsport, I'm your gal.
I find it a big struggle to be a Formula One fan. You have to get up quite early in the morning to watch the races.
Yeah, when we are in the European season, which is happening at the moment, races start at 1 a.m. And I'm that type of person that's like, if it's not live, I'm not getting the full experience. So I put myself through the pain of having a nap at 9 a.m, waking up at 12:30 a.m. to get ready for the sport, or just sticking it out, staying up, pulling an all-nighter. And it's always, well, I mean, recently it has all resulted in the same thing, which is Max Verstappen leading every lap and then taking the checkered flag. And I will say, I can recognise my biases here, because that is kind of a cornerstone of Formula One, is one team nailing the regulations and dominating until the next regulations come about, and then the cycle repeats. That in the last round of regulations, the team that dominated was Mercedes with my guy Lewis Hamilton. And so when Lewis Hamilton was doing what Max Verstappen is doing now, I didn't really have a problem with it, because that's my guy. So at least I can recognize my biases, but it's still bloody pissing me off. I don't want to have to wake up at 1 a.m, stay up for an hour and a half of the same old shit. But what can we do? What can we do? The discussion has been, do you make Red Bull slower? But then no, the spirit of Formula One is, if you build the best car, you win. You can't put any kind of hindrances on that, because then that just defeats the purpose of Formula One.
Now, how far through the season are we in Formula One? For someone that doesn't keep up with it, like I said before, I know that we've just had the Hungarian Grand Prix, which of course Max Verstappen did take out.
Of course.
As per usual. What have we got coming up?
This weekend we have the Belgian Grand Prix at Spa-Francorchamps. The track is controversial in quite a sad and morbid way. There is this part of Spa called Eau Rouge, and it goes into Radion, and it's one of the most, as a spectacle, it is gorgeous to see the cars going up the hill, taking this corner at full tilt, but it has killed people, this corner. In Formula 2 in 2019, we lost Antoine Hubert, a young French guy who spun out and was basically T-boned by another driver, and he died. And then just, I want to say 3 weeks ago, we suffered another death in very, very similar circumstances at the exact same place. And it's kind of ignited the debate of, where do we draw the line? Is it, do we let them go out and, you know, high risk, high reward, give it a go. If you crash, you crash. That's what the sport is. Or do you need to kind of play a paternalistic role and be like, hey, it's not safe. People have died. People have been seriously injured. And do we draw a stake and be like, this is where we draw the line, when people's safety is at risk? I personally don't know where I draw the line on that, because with the most recent death at Spa, which was 18-year-old Dutch driver, I believe, the issue was poor race control. They shouldn't have let a bunch of kids in very fast cars go out when it was pissing down, the spray was intense, very low visibility. And so if someone spins out and is, you know, horizontal on the track, and you come up around this really high speed corner, you're not going to see them. And is that the fault of the driver, or is that the fault of race control, who can realistically foresee this happening given all the other instances of accidents we've had? So what I think is that in 2021, the Belgian Grand Prix, Formula One Belgian Grand Prix, did not go ahead. It kind of, they just drove around behind the safety car for a few laps until the race could be classified. People were pissed off at that because they come to see a race and they don't see a race. But if you let racing happen in those conditions and someone got seriously hurt or injured, you would kind of be like, yeah, no, they should have cancelled this. It's kind of, I see it as like a lose-lose situation for everyone.
Obviously, that's a big topic of conversation, is the safety within Formula One, and the sport's always evolving, motorsport's always evolving in terms of its safety.
The saying in Formula One is that safety regulations are written in blood. It takes a big accident for us to be like, wait a minute, this needs changing. What I think about is the halo. You guys know what the halo is in Formula One? It's that big titanium structure that goes over the top of the car. That was implemented, you know, in my opinion, far too late, when Jules Bianchi had a serious accident at the Japanese Grand Prix where he went under a tractor that was recovering a stricken car. And so the halo came, I want to say, 2 or 3 years after his death. People hated it. People hated it. They're like, it's ugly, it impedes the drivers, it's just not worth it. You know, it's a tough sport, it's a high-risk sport, so they should just, you know, not have these safety regulations. But the halo has been probably the best thing that has ever happened to Formula One. I have no doubt that we would have seen plenty more deaths without it. And just thinking Monza 2021 at the Italian Grand Prix, where Max Verstappen and Lewis Hamilton had that accident where Max's car ended up on top of Lewis Hamilton's car. Without the halo, Lewis would be headless, to be honest. In a morbid way, Lewis would be goners. Safety over spectacle, what do you choose? It's a fine balance.
Your proper football update. On 95 BFM's The Playbook.
This really wouldn't be a proper football update without mentioning the stellar performance our football ferns had last week. We have Holly Thorpe, a professor of sociology, gender and sport at Te Whare Wānanga o Waikato, the University of Waikato, for a kōrero about why this is so exciting and historic for our wahine footballers here in Aotearoa, New Zealand.
Yeah, to be honest, I was very excited and happily surprised at the result. I was not expecting that. I think many New Zealanders might have felt the same way, given the previous sort of losing streak of the football ferns. They'd lost about 10 games in a row, except for a pre-tournament win over Vietnam. So to come out and win 1-0 over a previous World Cup champion was a big deal, to take that from Norway. And I just think it, you know, obviously Hannah Wilkinson's goal was incredible. They fought so hard that whole game. But to also see so many New Zealanders come out to support them, you know, we had a record crowd of, you know, 42,000 people in the stadium there. And that's a big deal for not only for women's sport, but obviously women's football in New Zealand.
To have over 42,000 screaming fans at Eden Park must have been a crazy experience. It felt like such a significant sporting moment for our country and especially for women's football.
Yeah, I think it's significant, and we've got lots of layers to this particular moment in time, right? Like the women's game of football around the world has been growing, building bigger audiences. You know, women have been fighting really hard for visibility, for pay, for opportunity. So we've got those kind of global trends where women's football is growing in popularity and visibility. And then in Aotearoa, New Zealand, you know, we've had a very strong government investment in women and girls sport participation and also active recreation and play. So that's about, you know, getting people playing, moving, active lifestyles out in our communities. And then also in terms of athletes and leadership roles, and because, you know, sport from forever basically has been created by men and for men. And so there's been a lot of work that's needed to go on behind the scenes to try to get to some versions of equality in terms of opportunities for women and girls. And so with that, we've had a big investment from the government that's come through Sport New Zealand and their Women and Girls strategy. But we've also had, you know, this Football Women's World Cup is on the back of the Women's Rugby World Cup, where we obviously saw New Zealanders get behind the Black Ferns, fall in love with the team, see the potential in women's sport to entertain and inspire and connect with people in the ways that men's rugby hasn't for a while. And so And then we had the cricket before that. So, you know, we've got, you know, three major Women's World Cups being hosted here in New Zealand. And that's partly because of government support and a lot of people working really, really hard to get to some version of an equal playing field.
This is a long time coming as well. Women were discouraged or banned from playing right up to the 1960s. Women's football has a long history in Aotearoa that dates back to the first decade of the 20th century, and generations of extremely talented and dedicated players have essentially had to fight to play, be visible and respected within clubs and organisations.
Most sports do have long gendered histories of women having to fight really hard to just be there. But yeah, women's football, I mean, this is coming from Dr. Alida Shank's PhD research that she just finished earlier this year from Massey University. And she looked at the history of the women's game here in New Zealand. And this actually goes back to the first decade of the 20th century, sort of women starting to play the game and then, you know, society sort of saying, no, that's not appropriate for women and girls. It's too rough. It's too physical. They could, you know, compromise their ability to, you know, raise children, et cetera. It's not feminine. It's not socially appropriate. And so in New Zealand and many other parts of the world, women were banned from playing football as they were banned from playing many other sports that were socially considered as too physical, too masculine, too risky. And so, yeah, like you say, it was from around the 60s that we saw women like, no, we're going to play and we're going to play well. And so they started organising themselves, putting more pressure on male-dominated football clubs, creating their own associations to play, to have fun, to enjoy the game, to develop the game and to enjoy it at all levels. And so we've seen women fighting really hard to grow the game. And so when we see what happened last week, we see New Zealand hosting or co-hosting with Australia the Women's World Cup here, you know, it's on the back of just decades and decades of really hard work and women, and, you know, some men too, fighting really hard for these opportunities. So it's a big deal.
Now, despite obstacles that have been put in place for decades, football's popularity with girls and women has continued to grow, with participation rates increasing by over 35% since 2011. Now, this is according to New Zealand Football. What are your thoughts on this?
Now, these events are so much more than, you know, that high performance, what we see on the field, right? Like, obviously, the football ferns and how they play and, you know, that's all a big part of this. But obviously, hosting all these other teams is really important, bringing out, you know, aspects of New Zealand society to celebrate, you know, whether it's the Vietnamese team or the, you know, it's so cool to see all walks of life in New Zealand coming out to support women's football. But you know, it's much more than what happens on the field as well. It's all that kind of the ripple effects that happen from this. And, you know, there's a whole lot of talk about legacy, right? So, the you know, FIFA and even the bid, that the co-bid that New Zealand and Australia put in, it's all about the legacy of these events. So much more than just opportunities for the players on the field, obviously the visibilities, building an audience, building fan base. But it's also about people valuing women's sport, you know, girls and boys are seeing and respecting women's athleticism. And, you know, supposedly that has this trickle-down effect into our local communities and people, you know, supporting girls and boys equally in terms of playing football on a Saturday morning, etc. But, you know, the research around that kind of trickle-down effect is a bit blurry, actually, and it doesn't really show that when we host a mega event, people will actually go out and be more active. But, so, you know, what we've seen in New Zealand with Football New Zealand, with Sport New Zealand, with various regional football organisations, we've seen a real focus on really capitalising on this idea of legacy. So, you know, they have the programs in schools now. They have programs with young girls and young women to really, you know, make the most of this event. So it's, you know, all the fan zones and all of this is about building people's interest and support for women and girls' participation. And so that's the bigger kind of legacy part of this. So it's not even about what we see on the field. It's not just about how many dollars the international visitors bring to New Zealand and spend in New Zealand when they're, you know, travelling around the various games. It's actually around 5-10 years down the track, what was the impact of this event in terms of girls and women participating in sport, having active lifestyles, and then obviously we know that there's you know, health benefits of that when people enjoy moving in their lives, and then obviously the government benefits when they don't, you know, have to cover the health bills at the other end. So it's all connected. It's much bigger than what we see on the field. It's all this kind of ripple effect, and it's hard to measure that stuff, but what we've seen is a really like multi-layered approach from sports organisations in New Zealand. They're really trying to leverage off this event, and they've done it with the rugby and the cricket as well. And I think it's building a momentum in New Zealand. We've got a real energy about women's sport that we've never seen before. And I think that's exciting.
It's amazing to see how far women's football has come, but there's evidence that shows there is still work to be done. In your article posted on The Conversation not too long ago, you brought up that we still have to improve the conditions for women as athletes and as leaders. You've also mentioned the government has pledged $19 million to upgrade facilities, including improved accessibility, along with gender-neutral spaces in some stadiums. So there's still a lot of work to be done here.
I think that's such an important point. Like, we shouldn't just be, you know, I'm here being very optimistic, but I'm a critical sociologist, so I need to be realistic. And so we have these kind of moments where we have this momentum, but it's not a linear process or progress over time where it's just we build. Actually, you know, sometimes these events have passed and, you know, sports organisations tick the gender box. Oh, we did that so well. Let's pat ourselves on the back. Now let's go back to the normal, which is investing and funding and supporting men's sport. We can't do that, right? But that could easily happen. And like you say, there are still so many challenges. There are still, you know, football clubs across the country where women are not feeling valued and respected and treated with you know, equally to their male colleagues in terms of funding, in terms of access, in terms of people listening to their and respecting their voices. We've still got major issues going on there. And so we got to keep our foot on the pedal. And, you know, I think more broadly, audiences have got to keep showing up for women's sport and keep putting the pressure on local, regional, national organisations to keep providing, keep asking those questions in terms of who are we actually reaching. You know, when we're talking about women and girls, what women and girls? Where are the missing groups? Who's not included in some of these policies and some of these initiatives? We really need more intersectional approaches where we recognise how gender intersects with culture and ethnicity and class and sexuality. And we've got so many, you know, sports organisations often focus on women and girls and then they tick that box. But we really need to, in the wave going forward, we really need to be working at those critical intersections where it gets messy and complex. I'm also a little bit worried. We've had, obviously, Minister of Sport Grant Robertson has been a huge advocate for women and girls in sport. That's been a big push for him. And he's been a huge champion for it, actually. And so, you know, we've got an election coming up, and what happens next when that funding runs out? Does this all just, you know, disappear, or does the pressure keep coming from the top down on sports organisations to step up and do better in terms of providing for women and girls? I hope not, but, you know, I think we've still got a lot of work to do. Sport, you know, we continue to have all these cases of sportswomen reporting abuse and harm in sport. You know, we've still got a lot of toxic sporting cultures where women are not treated well. So we've got a huge amount of work to do. So yeah, we can pat ourselves on the back for hosting an amazing mega event, but we've got to keep putting the pressure on because we've got a long way to go.
Thank you to Holly Thorpe, a professor of sociology, gender and sport at Te Whare Wānanga o Waikato, the University of Waikato, for having a kōrero with us. Staying on the topic of football, we've got one of our resident football experts here in the studio to give his football roundup.
The Playbook.
I'm missing fucking Emmerdale for this.
Sucker.
Hi, Smashton.
Smashton here.
How's it going?
Good, I'm good. Very interesting season interval at the moment. Last season ended recently. Man City took out the treble, I believe. Champions League, Premier League, and one of the cups. I don't know which one. I think it was Carabao Cup.
Is it kind of like a cop-out just to go and support Man City now? Like, if you...
Oh, for sure.
Is it a bit like, yes. Oh, they're the best team, so just go support them?
Yep, definitely. Absolute cop-out. But that's what some people are after, you know? Some people want the glory. See, I'm not fussed about that. I support West Ham United, which is a... Wait, can we swear on this?
Yeah.
I'll try not to.
No, you can.
Yes, I believe it is a cop-out to support Man City. But some people are glory hunters. Some people want to watch games and see wins. And that's their jurisdiction. I support West Ham. It's a pretty back-and-forth team to support. A lot of potential we've got, but we just never seem to fulfill it. On the contrary to that, we are now European champions. We won the UEFA Conference League last year. Best football game ever.
You're
fantastic.
Ecstatic. You are quite ecstatic about that.
I was thrilled after, as Amelia said, getting up to watch Formula One at the arse end of the morning. Getting up to watch any football outside of Australasia is a pain in the ass. And it was a nail-biter of a game. It was 1-1 up until the 89th minute. When Jared Bowen scored the winner, and it was fucking awesome. It was like 7 o'clock in the morning. I was screaming and punching my bed. It was amazing. I was so happy.
Resident football expert, I would like to know your thoughts on Saudi Arabia and their presence at the moment, trying to lure in some of Europe's best and Europe's most average, Jordan Henderson, to play. For the big bucks over there in the Saudi League.
So I was actually going to talk about this in like a transfer roundup, which I presume we would have done. But it's what's taken the football world by storm, is the Saudi Arabian pillaging of every league around the world. For a quick roundup of what it is, essentially Saudi Arabia is offering a shit ton of money to players to move to Saudi Arabia and play in the Saudi Arabian League. Now, this isn't the first time this has happened. It happened 5 or 6 years ago in China, where not as high-profile players...
What do you mean Paulinho's not high-profile?
Who?
That Brazilian fellow?
Pauline?
Played for Barcelona.
Ah,
for a year or two.
Paolo. No, so they did the same in China in like 2014-15, offered players more than $1 million New Zealand a week. And it didn't work out because they went broke.
Mm.
And players stuck around on 1 year contracts and they left, and it didn't gain any more viewership than it normally would have. And all the players that signed big contracts in China are gone now.
The flop.
Yes.
Because when you're playing in a league that is not that great, you're not going to be seen as good as you once were. For example, Jordan Henderson, when you're playing in the Prem, captaining a Premier League team, to then go to Saudi Arabia and still expect to get playing time for your country, I think that's, wishful thinking from a lot of these players.
And Jordan Henderson is very average at best as well.
Yeah, well, and the thing that bloody F's me off about Jordan Henderson is that he willingly became an advocate for the queer community. No one asked him to root so hard for the queer community, wear that rainbow armband, then to just chuck it all in the bin for a couple bags. I just think that is so depressing and is just really indicative of the state of the world and bloody
money
capitalism.
Money talks.
It bloody does.
It does. But on the topic of the Saudi Arabian pillaging of football, already we are not even halfway through this transfer window and there's been some seriously high-profile players gone across to Saudi Arabia for some serious money. Premier League giants, legends such as Kalidou Koulibaly, Roberto Firmino, N'Golo Kante all have gone over to Saudi Arabia for the big bucks.
I literally did not know that.
No, did you not?
Kante?
No, Al-Ittihad.
Oh,
on a free.
Oh my goodness.
Benzema?
Yeah. I would expect that from him.
He's in the same.
He's a bloody
Benzema,
rat
he had good reason though.
Yeah, because he's going to go to prison anywhere else. What did he do? He blackmailed
his
Valbuena.
Yeah, Valbuena, that's right. That's a story for
another
day.
That's a story and a half.
But Karim Benzema, Bunda! Now, Karim Benzema essentially justified his move by saying, I'm a Muslim man, I've never lived in a Muslim country, so I'm going to play in Saudi
Arabia.
That's
fair, and I don't know who it was that I saw basically said, we're playing for the money.
Yeah, absolutely.
Like, as long as you can be honest and say, hey, we're playing for the money, fair dues.
Because
if you say, yeah,
money.
It's the Saudi League, they're just a developing football league and we're going to help them develop it. I don't buy that.
Absolutely
one bit.
Not. So a lot of majority of the players that have gone over are definitely past their prime, like Benzema, Kante, Firmino, but there are some young bucks that have been poached up too. Gonzalo Plata, he's an Ecuadorian, 22 years old, went from Real Valladolid in the Spanish second tier to Al Sadd in Qatar, wrong country, but also Jota. I was really, really disappointed about Jota. Jota's a young Portuguese winger. He's 24 years old, played for Celtic under new Tottenham manager Ange Postecoglou. Koglu, and he went to Saudi Arabia, and he could have excelled So he's just an absolute. He has the flair. He has the pace. He has the footballing ability, but he also has the strength. He could have been. I highly rate him, and now he's just gone to Saudi Arabia for the bag. Hopefully, he doesn't spend all his time there. But hey, who knows what's going to happen?
They've offered Kylian Mbappe quite the bag.
300 million euros.
He is not at all keen.
PSG have accepted the bid,
but it's up to him, right? He can just say, "I'm not negotiating with you. You can't force me to move anywhere. I'll stay benched this whole next season if I need to. I'm not going anywhere."
He could do that, but he probably wouldn't be benched. He'd just get released. He'd be a free agent, and then PSG would lose a shit ton of money.
And he wants to go to Madrid in the end, eh? That's the goal.
It's Mbappe. He's very arrogant.
Yeah.
So, like, I mean, this is a very basic assumption. Like, he's probably, like, an okay bloke if you get to know him. But in the footballing sense, he is pretty up himself, which, to be fair,
he's very Neymar vibes.
Yes, and Ronaldo vibes especially. If he went to Al-Hilal, 300 mil... like 70 million euros a month or something. Even like Jordan, 100% do it.
Yeah.
So Jordan Henderson, he was on £125,000 in Liverpool, captaining Liverpool's boyhood club. Now he's in Al Ittihad with Steven Gerrard as manager. He's on £700,000 a week.
Whoa! I'm just trying to think. Surely you run out of ways to spend that money.
It's Saudi Arabia.
True.
Fucking Lamborghinis and boats and shit. I went to Dubai last year in the UAE. Holy shit.
They sell number plates for hundreds of thousands of dollars. If you've got a number plate with a low number on it, it shows wealth and success.
It's absurd. Like, it kind of blew me away. I really didn't like going to do... this is not completely irrelevant. I'm not going to continue. One last bit of football news. Lionel Messi, officially an MLS player at Inter Miami, and I am very happy. He scored 3 goals in 2 games, and he looks so happy.
Yeah,
very happy.
I saw a headline that said, "Is Lionel Messi just good or is MLS just bad?" And I'm like, why not both?
MLS is up and coming, definitely.
Yeah, for sure.
I think so. I think the standard of football there is... I bag the MLS because America, you kind of have to by default as like a somewhat English country, being New Zealand. But I think the MLS and the Major League Rugby is coming up, both of them.
Major League Rugby?
Yeah, it's a Major League Rugby. It's not quite on the heights of MLS, but it's getting up there. One of my old schoolmates plays there. And lots of, if you go through the teams in the Major League Rugby, you'll be surprised at who plays there. Adam Ashley Cooper? Major League
Cricket.
Rugby? Yeah. But just one last thing on the Inter Miami topic. 4 ex-Barca players are there now from that golden era.
We've got Bussi.
Bussi. Busquets, Jordi Alba.
Jordi Alba, yes.
Messi and Iniesta.
Wow.
Not confirmed, but we go.
Because he is coach at Vissel Kobe?
He was, he's just a player.
Oh, he's just hanging about. Okay.
Yeah.
Hey, why the hell not go into Miami then?
But I think it'll be interesting. Just transfer window ends September 1st. It'll be very interesting to see what happens in Saudi Arabia.
Have we got some big expectations? Who do you reckon's next? What's the next big transfer?
I mean, the next Saudi... I don't know about the next big transfer, but definitely the next Saudi Arabia one. Well, not definitely, but most likely, Riyad Mahrez. He's heading there.
Fair enough.
Yeah.
The Playbook. A whole lot of sports stuff.
And that's the Playbook for the 28th of July is the date, I do believe.
Yes, you're right on that one.
Thanks to you for listening.
Every Friday you can catch us here chatting about the weirdest in sports.
And everything else that may or may not involve sports. We'll see you guys next week.
See ya!
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.